Chambers v. State. Good afternoon, Mr. Bernstein.
Justice Holland, Justice Risley, Justice Berger, good afternoon. My name is Joseph Bernstein. I'm representing Joseph Chambers, who's the appellant in this case. I think in order to understand and appreciate the error that we believe occurred here and the prejudice that occurred here, you really need to appreciate and understand the historical facts that led up to the objection that was made in this particular case concerning Quinton Davis's testimony. Quinton Davis, at the time of the trial, was, I believe, 16 or 17 years old. He was questioned by the police approximately four or five times, gave four or five recorded statements. I don't recall exactly how many there were. There were at least four, and every one was different in significant respects. There was one statement, a statement on May 28th, where he implicated Joseph Chambers in this homicide. And Quinton Davis, I think it's fair to say, was a critical witness, if not the star witness, for the state in this case. Quinton Davis gets on the stand and
excuse me, let me stop you right there. How can somebody who's given four or five conflicting statements be a star witness?
Because I think in the state's mind, he was an individual who ultimately told the state, I was with Chambers right before this shooting happened and right after this shooting happened, and Chambers told me he shot Gregory Graves. This is a case where there were no eyewitnesses.
Right. No. What I'm getting at is this. My understanding is that several of his statements were not incriminatory toward your client. Several of his statements didn't identify your client as having committed the crime, right?
Correct.
So on day one, he says yes. On day two, he says no. On day three, he says yes again. Doesn't that make him a seriously impaired witness in terms of credibility?
In terms, he had credibility problems. There's no question about that. What I'm talking about in terms of the state viewed him as a critical witness for the state, simply because one of these statements implicated a defendant. And the state's argument was, believe what he said on May 28th, don't believe anything else he said.
Right, and what I'm trying to get at is, what difference does it make whether he gave the pro-state version on the witness stand or his I don't know anything and I was making it all up statement on the witness stand, since there's this long history of him going back and forth and you're going to be able to get to that no matter what?
That's true. But from the state's standpoint, they wanted to present a witness who was telling one consistently whole story that implicated the defendant, and obviously they had to take their chances on cross-examination with the other stories that this witness said. But from their standpoint, if they're going to make any headway with the jury, they want the jury to see a witness who is coming into court telling a story that is consistent with what the state believes happened, without all this baggage, and leave it to the defense to come after him.
Well, and did that happen here?
Well, what happened here was Quinton Davis didn't follow the script. Quinton Davis gets on the stand, and I think the state realized, even before they put him on the stand, that there might be problems, because the very first statement, the very first questions of this witness from the state were to the effect of, you really don't want to be here. Aren't you afraid? And those prompted objections that were sustained. And then when the state begins actually starting to zero in on this May 28th statement, Quinton Davis, to use a colloquial term, goes south on the state. He denies making the statement. He denies knowing anything. For a prosecutor, I suspect, it's the worst possible thing that can happen. And the prosecutor's reaction to this witness going south was to ask for a recess.
Now, in the records, it seems to suggest the purpose of the recess was to decide whether to pursue introduction of the 3507 statement. And one way to read the record is that the witness was taken into custody because this material witness warrant really hadn't been executed. And the witness was down in the holding cell. And then the witness initiated the idea of contact with the detective or chief investigating officer. Is that an
accurate? I don't think that that is supported by the record in this case.
What's your
understanding? I don't think it's.
What do you think? What's the scenario as you understand the record?
At some point during the recess, there was contact between the chief investigating officer and the witness. I don't believe there's anything in the record about who initiated the contact.
Well, what didn't the prosecutor seek permission for the chief investigating officer to make the contact?
Yes. And that was what was objected to.
Okay. But that permission was granted.
That permission was granted.
And so is that what happened, or are you saying something else happened?
I assume that's what happened. They were given permission to talk to him.
Well, I guess when we're the reason it's important to know the facts is because we're trying to understand the rule you're advocating. In your brief, you acknowledge that perhaps, I don't want to characterize the adjectives you used in your brief, but let's say perhaps, there are federal cases that go the other way. And notwithstanding that, we should adopt the rule that basically wouldn't have contact with a witness when they're testifying, irrespective of whether it's direct testimony or cross-examination, although in this case, we might even be able to stay with cross-examination because this was a hostile witness and they were permitted to ask leading questions.
That's correct.
So what's the rule that you're advocating?
I think in this particular case, I don't think you have to make a rule as broad as, for example, once a witness takes the stand, nobody can talk to that witness about his testimony until that witness has concluded his testimony. I'm not advocating that rule, although that might not be a bad rule. We have that rule, I believe, in the civil side.
In depositions.
In depositions.
What is the rule that you're advocating?
Well, in this particular case, as Your Honor just pointed out, this was like a cross-examination. It was very clear to the state from probably even before he took the stand that there were going to be problems with this witness, and very early on in the direct testimony, the prosecutor asked the judge for permission to treat him as a hostile witness, which was granted. So if you just take the Webb case and say this, maybe it wasn't technically on cross-examination, but as a practical matter, it was, we have a situation where the attorney who's examining this witness is having problems with the witness. And my point here is it's just unfair and it's wrong to be able to allow a prosecutor to say, time out, we want to have a pep talk with the witness.
Well, that's why I went back to the facts. If they were the facts, then clearly that is the way the decision may unfold. But you have to help us with the facts because the state represents that a recess was taken. And during the recess, while the prosecutor was trying to decide how to react to the witness, and Mr. George used the word going south, and the witnesses in the holding cell that it was the witness's idea to talk to the detective. So if those are the facts, and then we have to decide whether the trial judge properly ruled on that request of the witness to initiate the contact.
Well, I think aside from who initiated the contact, the problem as I see it is what happened during that contact. If they just talked about the weather, no problem. But the chief investigating officer, after this conversation, came back into court and was asked, what did you tell, what was the gist of your conversation? He said, well, I told him to tell the truth. Now, when you put that in the context of someone who's given...
There was also discussion about safety, wasn't there?
There was a concern about the from the witness about people in the courtroom who the witness felt were intimidating him. Nevertheless, this witness was told by an arm of the prosecutor, investigating officer, well, just tell the truth. Now, what the truth is, nobody knows.
Well, but that comes back to the record, and that's why I want you to help us understand the record. One way to read the record is the witness said, first, I'm being intimidated. And the detective says, well, you have to tell the truth. And the witness said, well, as long as those people are in the courtroom, I don't feel comfortable testifying, which led to the colloquy with the judge where the detective said, this fellow feels uncomfortable testifying unless several people are taken out of the courtroom. And the judge said, okay, we'll do that. Now, what part of what I just said is supported by the record?
I think that's all on the record.
Okay.
Obviously, the witness had a concern about being intimidated by people in the audience. Now, whether that led him to say what he was saying or something else led him to go south, if you will, it's hard to understand what his motivation was. But the cure that... The road that the state took in this case, and they could have taken another road, and that road would have been less desirable for the state, that is, take him off the stand, play his out-of-court statement for the jury, put him back on the stand.
All right, well, let's...
They didn't want to do that.
Well, one of the variables in this case is we have the judge interacting. But let's suppose that we adopt your rule, and then a witness, the exact same witness, in the cell, simply waiting for the trial to resume, sends a note to the judge and said, I'm being intimidated by the gestures of the people in the courtroom. And the judge gets that note and talks to the two trial attorneys, the defense attorney and the prosecutor. If your rule is adopted, what does the judge do in the next case when they get that note?
Well, under that scenario, the witness hasn't taken the stand yet.
No. In my hypothetical, it's the same situation as this case. The witness is on the stand, and there's a break, a recess, but because the person's a material witness, they're in the holding cell. But, you know, while their testimony's interrupted, they want the judge to know they're feeling intimidated by the crowd, you know, in the courtroom.
I think it's permissible to talk to the witness about anything but his testimony. I think the line was crossed here when the investigator, I mean, there's one way to deal with intimidation, and that was dealt with. And I think it's another matter to be able to, I'm not going to say coach, but encourage the witness to get back on the team. And I think that's what happened here. It may have been a little bit of trying to mitigate his fears about being intimidated by people in the courtroom, But the line, I think the line was crossed here when it's very clear that the investigator reminded the witness why he was there and what he was supposed to say. And I think that's the problem here. It's just unfair, whether it's a state's witness or a defense witness, if things start going bad, and things happen in trials that they don't always play out the way the lawyers think they're going to play out. Things happen.
Now, does the record show that the investigator did what you just described, reminded the witness why he was there and what he was supposed to say?
Well,
or is it what you said earlier, that he told him to tell the truth?
Well, the exact literal quote from the investigator was, "I just told him to tell the truth."
Okay, so that's all the record has.
That's in the record. And that's all.
That's all.
That's correct.
And you're saying that crosses the line?
I think any time that you have a conversation with a witness who's on the stand about his testimony, and I would suggest that encouraging somebody to tell the truth or encouraging somebody to lie, whatever it is crosses the line in terms of attempting to influence that person's testimony. Whatever you tell them, if the purpose of it is to influence what that person's going to say, and here you have a person who is obviously, before the recess, going totally south on the state, and the state has a problem. How are we going to deal with this? One way to deal with it, well, let's just put his out-of-court statement on and let the jury sort it out. And, of course, that strategy conveys to the jury that this is a witness who the state has problems with.
Well, let me interrupt you for a second. Mr. Bernstein, you're making it sound as if the state puts a witness on the stand, an important witness. The witness turns bad on them and is not giving them the testimony they want. So the state calls a recess and then goes and tries to pump up their witness to get him back in line. And, you know, that sounds a whole lot different to me than what I believe the facts are here, which is that the witness is going south, the state calls a recess, but the state does not then say, oh, we want to go talk to this guy and get him back in line. It's that the state is busy making its plans of what it's going to do to deal with its problem, having nothing to do with talking to the witness, but the witness asks to talk to the investigator because the witness has independent concerns having to do with who's in the courtroom. And that's, you know, that's why there's a conversation, and the conversation is basically about getting these people who are scaring the witness out of the courtroom.
I think it's one thing you left out.
Okay.
And what you left out was that before the recess was even taken, the state asked the court for permission to talk to him.
We want to encourage that. I'm sorry.
What wasn't that because they had gotten some word that he had asked to speak to them, so they then
this was before he was even taken downstairs.
Well, I'd like to see that in the record because that's not consistent with my understanding.
I've got a few minutes to rebuttal.
Okay.
Maybe
you can find that.
Okay.
Thanks. Good afternoon, Mr. Carroll.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. For the record, Kevin M. Carroll, Deputy Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state in this matter. I think a good point to begin with is where the court left off during the appellant's opening time. And that concerned the question of the substance of Detective Armstrong's conversation with Mr. Davis here. And I refer the court to appendix to the appellant's opening brief, appendix page 17. And with the court's indulgence, I'd like to quote from that because I think the words ring true here. Detective Armstrong says, and that's basically what he told me. He wants to sit down. He wants to tell the truth, okay? But he's dealing with, and I noticed when he testified, he continuously looked to the back row, you know, for whatever reason. But I was watching his eyesight when Mr. George was interviewing him, and it was continuously directed on the other side. So there's something going on there that makes him uncomfortable. It wasn't Detective Armstrong telling the witness to testify truthfully. That wasn't the question.
Well, that quote you read, though, is a little different than the witness saying, I'd like to talk to the detective, and the first thing out of the witness's mouth is, I'm feeling intimidated. What's your understanding on the scenario? Because that seems to suggest the witness never said he felt intimidated. It was Detective Armstrong inferring from his demeanor on the stand that he felt intimidated.
Well, certainly, Justice Hyland, and I don't mean to downplay Mr. Davis's fear here. It was well-founded. It was documented throughout the record here. And indeed, before Detective Armstrong discussed the substance of his conversation with Mr. Davis, he discussed also the fear that that Mr. Davis has been getting, talking about, you know, nothing overt but implied threats to him.
Well, and that's why I asked Mr. Bernstein to help us with the record, and I'd like you to do the same thing, because Mr. Bernstein concluded his remarks by saying, before Mr. Davis was ever taken to the holding cell, the state said, we want to talk to him. And then there seems to be a suggestion that perhaps that did not occur, but Davis was taken to the holding cell and sent a message that he wanted to talk to the detective. And then the state said to the trial judge, is it all right if the detective talks to the witness? The witness would like to talk to the detective. So that's one part of the record it would be helpful to clear up. Then the second part of the record is, when the detective gets there, is Davis saying, first thing, I feel intimidated? Or is the detective saying, first thing, you know, you've got to tell the truth here?
Yeah. If I can help the court clear this up, I think context matters here. Here, throughout the, you know, before Mr. Davis took the stand, there's been concerns expressed to him, expressed to the prosecutor about feelings of intimidation and fear that he felt. This was made known to the court by Mr. George, the prosecutor in this case, and it continued. Now, when the recess came, the recess that becomes the focus of this appeal came, there was, you know, consistent with his representation to the court that he was looking to, you know, introduce Mr. Davis's statements via 3507, the prosecutor requested a brief recess. At that point, there was some discussion among counsel and the court that, you know, pertaining to Mr. Davis's status, whether or not he was a material witness and if he should be held or things on that matter. At that point, Mr. George brings to the court's attention that Mr. Davis wants to speak with Detective Armstrong. Faced with that, the court grants permission.
Obviously, Mr. George and Mr. Davis were talking.
I don't know if it was, Your Honor, and I refer, if I may have a second, there was a point during the court's hearing on the motion for mistrial where Mr. George expresses to the court that it came to his attention that Mr. Davis wanted to speak with Detective Armstrong, and that was, I have a second here. I believe it's at transcript page 8788 on the 18th of March, 2005. I'm not sure of that, but the essence of it is to discuss, you know, Mr. George brings to the court's attention that information came to him that Mr. Davis wanted to speak with Detective Armstrong, and for understandable reasons, they had a history. And then once Detective Armstrong spoke with Mr. Davis, his initial concerns, as related by Detective Armstrong during the proffer and the record made of the conversation, concerned the threats that he faced. A theme consistently and regularly emphasized by the prosecutor and brought out during, you know, the court's during Mr. Chambers' trial here. Moreover, there is, you know, evidence later on or a record basis for the court labeling Mr. Davis as a dead man walking, a threat relayed to the Department of Justice that caused increased security to be in place at the court I believe, beginning on the 18th. I'm not too sure if that was the date or if it was the 22nd. This is the context in which Mr. Chambers prays for a new rule of procedure here, and it's essentially a rule that would prohibit any communication between the state, the prosecutor, and any state officer and a witness during that witness's testimony, direct examination testimony. Unfortunately, there is no case law to support this, and moreover, the case law out there directly addresses cross-examination and talks about the unique role that cross-examination serves.
Well, so, wouldn't it be fair to say that this was more in the nature of cross-examination than direct examination? I mean, when this transpired, it was after a time that the request had been made and granted to treat this person as a hostile witness.
If I understand your question properly, Justice Berger, I tend to disagree. Cross-examination is more than just asking leading questions, which is what Mr. George requested here. As the court recognized in Webb, cross-examination is at the core of the adversarial process and serves a primary truth-seeking process here. So to claim just because Mr. Chambers was asked leading questions during direct examination testimony, to claim that that changes it into cross-examination, I think fundamentally misconstrues the purpose that cross-examination serves.
Well, I don't understand really how this is any different. You've got a witness. You've got an attorney asking this witness questions, and the attorney knows that this witness is not giving full or truthful answers, and the attorney is trying to force the witness, if you will, to give true and accurate answers. So instead of just asking the regular direct questions, he gets permission to ask leading questions, which are the classic technique of cross-examination that is intended to draw out the weaknesses in what this witness has already testified to. You didn't really do that, did you? You know, that kind of question.
Certainly.
So why is this particular situation, I'm not saying every one, but why isn't this particular situation virtually identical to cross-examination for purposes of not allowing conversations off the record until the examination is concluded?
Well, my answer to that would be that the context, again, needs to be taken into consideration here. The reason for cross-examination was Mr. Davis's genuine fear of intimidation or retaliation for his testimony, a theme reiterated by the trial court and by the prosecutor here. Moreover, the fact that Mr. Davis was
Let's try and focus on that for a minute. We've got a witness who is concerned for his safety.
Yes.
And that may, or purportedly, is the explanation for the way he's testifying and the fact that he's not being forthcoming in his testimony. To the extent that the state believes that there's a problem along these lines, why should that give the state the opportunity to have a private conversation with this witness as opposed to perhaps sending the jury out and having everybody present, including the judge and the prosecutor and the defense, and determine what the witness's concerns are and whether they should be addressed in one fashion or another? You're not telling me anything about this situation or about the intimidation factor that ipso facto leads me to the conclusion that, okay, a private conversation is okay. So tell me why that's the proper way to deal with a problem like this.
Here, nothing was done without the court's permission, Your Honor. It was a question of the court was aware of the intimidation, was aware of the reluctance that Mr. Davis had expressed on the stand. It's apparent from the transcripts. The yeses, noes, I don't know, I don't remember, maybes. At that point, yes, the prosecutor requested take a brief recess, but it was not for the purpose of getting a secret, meeting on the side with Mr. Davis. Rather, consistent with his representation to the court, was to allow the prosecutor time to figure out the best way of proceeding in light of the continued
reluctance. Right, but that's not what I'm focusing on now. What I'm saying is that at the point at which the state does request the opportunity to meet privately with the witness. I understand that the court gave them that opportunity, but what we're having to deal with is whether that's appropriate or not. And maybe it's something that, since the court didn't have any guidance on it, was an acceptable decision by the court, but maybe it wasn't. And I'm asking you why there aren't much more acceptable ways of dealing with the problem that you or the state is confronted with.
Well, if I understand your concerns here, Justice Berger, I think the trial judge himself here addressed that very concern. In the hearing on the motion for mistrial, the trial judge observed that he granted the state's request to allow the consultation with Mr. Davis because he found a proper purpose. And that proper purpose, again, derived from the context in which Mr. Davis took the stand.
Well,
and
Mr. Carroll, we're just looking at the transcript. What the trial judge said was, the witness is on direct.
Mm-hmm.
I know of no rule that says you can't talk to the witness for any reason since he's still testifying on direct.
Yes.
So the ruling doesn't appear to be related to a purpose. It seems to be related to the trial judge's perception of the fact that the witness was testifying on direct.
I would agree with that, Justice Holland, and I would also point out the fact that when ruling on the motion for mistrial, the trial judge did allude to the fact that, you know, this consultation was predicated on a proper purpose.
Now, help us go back to Justice Berger's question about the real status of the witness. Normally, when the state has a problem and says, I would like you to declare this witness to be hostile,
mm-hmm.
and normally you would say, I'd like to proceed as if I was conducting cross-examination. And the judge says, okay. Now, one of the things you do is ask leading questions, but the predicate for the declaration of the hostile witness and permitting the witness to be treated as if they're on cross is significant.
Mm.
But if we look at the trial judge's ruling, the trial judge said, you can talk to this witness because it's still the direct testimony, without any regard for the fact that the witness had been declared a hostile witness and was being treated as if it was cross-examination. Is that relevant to what we have to decide?
I think it is relevant for the court's decision here, Your Honor. Again, I would reference what the court allowed here. Was the court granted Mr. George's request to ask leading questions. Within that context, and when the court allowed the consultation,
he didn't declare him a hostile witness.
It's my understanding from reviewing the record that no, it was based primarily just on the state's request to ask leading questions of Mr. Davis here. And that was in light of his continued reluctance.
Well, what's the basis to allow leading questions unless he's a hostile witness?
Well, Your Honor, I think
is
there in this
time crunch or something?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think that, you know, obviously time concerns on that, which was a matter that the prosecutor brought to the court's attention, concerns with getting the information in via Section 3507 would obviously be more time-consuming and things like that. But I think here the important thing to focus on was that the trial court relied on this court's decision in Webb v. State, which said that there is no consultation allowed during cross-examination. Just because leading questions are asked here to facilitate the witness's reluctant testimony doesn't automatically and should not automatically transfer his direct examinations to cross-examination. He was still subject to cross-examination by Mr. Chambers. And
great. Well, let's suppose, this is a hypothetical.
Okay.
Let's suppose in the next trial, the state says, I'd like to have this witness declared to be a hostile witness. And the judge says, I grant your request. Then the prosecutor says, I'd like to proceed as if on cross-examination. And the trial judge says, I grant that request. So the record's crystal clear.
Mm-hmm.
You have a witness who started on direct, who's been declared hostile. The state's authorized to proceed as if on cross. Does Webb apply, or does Webb not apply?
It's a unique situation, Your Honor, that a lot of the context in which it came up would have to be taken into account. I would suggest that Webb does apply to a certain degree. However, Here we are dealing with a situation where if the court were to accept that Mr. Davis was being treated for all intents and purposes as if he was on cross-examination or being subject to cross-examination, then the overriding concerns about his safety and the substance of his conversation with Detective Armstrong afterwards and the fact that it did not touch upon his testimony need to be taken into account here.
So in essence, you're saying that if it was error to allow that conversation to take place, it was harmless error?
To the extent that there was any error here, Justice Berger, the state would suggest that it is harmless error. Mr. Chambers certainly had the opportunity to cross-examine Mr. Davis and did a fine job showing the inconsistencies here. And indeed, a regular theme became that Mr. Davis was anything but forthcoming with the truth. He was not deprived the opportunity to cross-examine on this or to argue it in summation. So the state would submit that to the extent there is any error, it would in fact be harmless. But consistent with this court's decision in Webb, since this was not cross-examination, clearly there was no error.
Well, let's get back to what opposing counsel talked about in terms of the strength of the state's case. Davis is described by opposing counsel as the star witness. Would you agree with that?
His testimony was relevant and did have an impact here, Your Honor. To classify him as a star witness, I think, would distract
okay, well,
from
what
the...
What else did you have? Assume Quentin Davis doesn't exist.
Well, there was also the testimony of the witness, Daniel Hay, who corroborated the admission that Mr. Chambers made while in the car, that he had in fact, shot Mr. Graves.
He's the one that got immunity.
Yes, Your Honor. There was also eyewitness testimony from Benita Evans, who placed the defendant at the scene. Prior to the shooting, placed Mr. Graves and Mr. Chambers together in a heated argument type situation. She couldn't exactly hear what was going on, but it became clear from the body language here that there was some type of animus between the two. And then, again, there's testimony from Davis and Hay here showing that Mr. Chambers went down past Mr. Graves, shot eventually to the area where he was shot. If the court has any other questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them now. Otherwise,
thank you.
Thank you.
I did go back through the transcript. The chronology is that the first thing the prosecutor did was ask the court for permission to ask leading questions. And that is in the appendix. I circled it.
We'll find it.
I think it's page A15.
Okay.
The next thing that happened was that Mr. George asked the court for a recess, and that's on page A16, transcript page 123. The third thing that happened was at page 129, Mr. George says, I understand the witness may want to talk with our detective. Can I have him go back there? So this was all happened before Mr. Hay went back down or Mr. Davis went back down to the lockup. And I guess I get back to the problem I have with what happened in this case is that where you have a situation where a witness, whatever witness it is, whether it's a prosecution witness or a defense witness, who says something you don't expect, or says something that leads you to believe he's, no matter how many interviews you had with him, he's not following what he told us before. You shouldn't be allowed to interrupt the trial, take a recess and attempt to rehabilitate that witness, whatever the witness's concerns are. I don't think it matters whether it was fear of somebody or just simply changing his mind. I don't think the witness's motivation for going south matters as much as how you deal with it. And the point...
Well, tell us what you think should have happened in terms of...
Well, I think what shouldn't have happened is what happened
what,
here.
What should have happened? Should the judge have brought the witness to chambers?
This is, at least in my experience, and I'm only talking anecdotally here, witnesses do present problems sometimes. And the way that I've always seen the problems dealt with is whoever seems to be having the problem would approach the bench and say, Your Honor, there's obviously something bothering the witness here. We need to find out what it is. And whatever's done is done in open court. Or whether it's asking the witness about, is there somebody in the courtroom who's intimidating you? Or whatever it is. Whatever's bothering the witness that might be causing the witness to do something unexpected.
I assume that's without the jury, right?
Yes, outside of the presence of the jury in open court. And the danger here is when you allow ex parte communications between attorneys and investigators and a witness while the witness is on the stand, there is a risk that improper considerations might arise. And you just
don't
know.
Do you think a fair reading of this record would support the proposition that this person was a hostile witness who was being treated as if on cross-examination?
I believe so. When Mr. George asked for permission to ask leading questions, I just didn't put my finger on that.
Did he have 15?
He, at that point, you have to remember, he leads off by saying, you don't want to be here, aren't you afraid? He knows going in that this witness might present some problems, but he forges ahead. And then he reaches a point where the witness, obviously, he's not getting anywhere with the witness. First, he has to treat him as, ask leading questions, which I would say is the equivalent of treating him as a hostile witness. That doesn't work. And then, instead of, in line with my suggestion, what I've seen happen, go to the judge and say, look, we got a problem with this witness. I don't know what it is, but we need to find out what it is. And whatever happens can happen in front of everybody. That didn't happen here.
All right. Well, your time is up, Mr.
Okay.
Bernstein.
I appreciate the extra few seconds. Thank you.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement, and we'll also take a short recess.